I think the elders gave me 15 extra minutes tonight. Oh, look there. Keith gave me a thumbs up. So I'm going to pull a Michael and do it from down here because I feel so much more connected to y'all than up there. It's like I'm in another planet up there. So I like to do it here. So with that said, I'm super excited about tonight. I am super excited about the opportunity and thank the elders for that ability to, or opportunity to teach tonight, teach the adult class. I hope it's going to be great for everyone. It has been for me. I don't know how anyone can teach a whole quarter multiple times because I feel like I got to prep for so long to teach one lesson. So anyhow, so to get started tonight, because we're going to have a ton of questions, I want a bunch of answers, and I want them to happen fast because we don't have a lot of time so that we can get through all this tonight. I want to get your minds racing and get ready to start answering right off the bat with a trivia question. And that question is, what's the only book in the Bible where God is not mentioned? Esther, that's right. So, however, what do we see in Esther with God, even though he's not mentioned? There we go. We see God's providence throughout the whole book, right? I mean, from the word go, we see God's hand in the whole book and all the events of it. So as we go through this, certainly my goal and our goal for tonight is what I'd like to do is as we go through the story as quickly as we can, and we're going to just try to hit big points, the big points of the story, but I'd like to try to pull out character traits, especially in Esther, as she has a bunch of them that I think apply to us as Christians. But also, there's some character traits we see in some of the other characters that are great and some that aren't so great. So that's what I'd like to do tonight. That's going to be our goal. So to get started, start off first off with the time period that this is set in. What's the time period? Does anyone know? When are we? Is all this happening in Esther? Who's king? All right, Ahasuerus, however you want to say it. Xerxes is another. So this sits in around the time of return from Babylonian captivity, around 485 to 465 BC is what I find. Some Jews had returned to Jerusalem to start to rebuild the temple, but many were remained scattered throughout the 127 provinces in the Persian Empire. What's the location of the events in the book? Where specifically? What city? Or citadel? Susa. All right. Chapter 1, verse 2. Or Shushan, I think, is another interpretation of that. Main characters. Who's our main characters in the book? I've got five. Esther. Corey said Mordecai. Haman. Vashti, the king, King Ahasuerus or Xerxes. All right, so there's five, and that's who we're really going to focus on tonight. So before we start in chapter one and start getting through, just want to talk a little bit about the relationship between Esther and Mordecai. It's very special, a little bit. Well, let's just talk about it. First off, how old was Esther when we're introduced to her in chapter 2? Anyone know? Good, because I don't know either. Exactly, she was young. That's what we're told, right? we don't have an age. We know, right. Chris said she was a virgin, so a young virgin. That's what we know about her, and that's it. You know, I don't know what age to put on that. You know, you could say late teens, you could say early 20s. Who knows for that day and time? But how are Esther and Mordecai related? First cousins. All right. So Esther was the daughter of Mordecai's uncle. So first cousins. And what happened to Esther's parents? That's right. So we don't know how they died. But when they died, we're told Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So based on that, and I just love that Johnny led the song tonight, Master of the Tempest is Raging, and talking about difficult times. Did Esther have some difficult times early in life? And she lost her parents, both of them. And that's probably as difficult as it gets, right? So based on that alone, you know, I think we see some qualities and character traits or qualities in Esther early on in life. What are those things that she may have, how may she have benefited from going through this early in life? Well, I'll give you one. I think she's very mature for her age. I say that because, have you ever seen maybe teenagers or kids that are just very mature, and if you get to know them, they've ended up having some difficult times in life. They've lost a parent. They lost both parents. They ended up being the mother figure, the father figure in their household, and you're like, wow, they're so mature for their age. I've seen some like that, and you know, some can take one angle and they maybe don't do so well and they struggle in life, but there's some who've stepped up and just blow you away on their maturity levels. So I think she's very mature for her age. I think we see that early on in the story. What else? So I've got maturity. What else did you think that helped her, some traits that's going to help her, especially as what she ends up becoming? What else do you think she... Okay. Okay. Ooh. Obedient. Who's she obedient to? All right. I got obedience and submissive. Submissive, and we see it towards the king throughout the story, but I think that quality started with Mordecai. I mean, if you think about your first cousin, whoever that might be, and they become your mom or your dad, you know, would you be able to be submissive? Would you be able to be obedient to that person? We see Esther was, and we're going to see it early on. We see it in chapter 2, verses 10 and 20. We can get to that, but verse 10 talks about Mordecai charging her to not reveal her lineage and that she's a Jew. We see in verse 20 talking, it mentions about she had been obedient for a long time to Mordecai. It makes mention of she had always been listening to Mordecai and done basically what he told her. So she was obedient to him. So I think that these three character traits she learned and she displayed early in life were critical in her role as queen and then ultimately what is going to be her role of saving her people. So, you know, as we already see, when we talk about this, you know, I think we see God's providence already at work, right? We see God using, I mean, you know, this situation with Esther is a bad deal, right? Early in life. It's not good. And God uses Esther and puts her in a place to be somewhere that he needs her and uses it for good. So, let's get into the beginning of it. Chapter 1. We are not going to go read through verses. Y'all already read it. I think everybody's familiar with the story. But chapter 1, we see King Ahasuerus. He holds a banquet. I call it for all the bigwigs that he's associated with, right? The nobles, all these people. You can read it in the first few verses. Big banquet for all the bigwigs. How long's the banquet? 6 months, right? What's the banquet for? To show off what? All his riches and glory, right? But for 6 months, I'm like, does it take that long? Really? Do you have that much that it takes 6 months, or is it just a big hoorah party? So Yeah, so he holds this thing for 6 months, and then we get to the end of 6 months, and then what happens? He holds another one, right? He holds a seven-day banquet, and who's this for? For the people of Susa, says from the greatest to the least, okay? So this is kind of for everybody in the citadel that's in this area where the king is. So at the end of the 7 days, we've gone 6 months, we've had a banquet. We've gone another 7 days, we've had this banquet. And at the end of the 7 days, on the seventh day, what does the king do? What did he do with her? He showed her off, right? All right, he sent for her to come and wanted to show her off. And what happened? All right, she refused. So, stop at this. And this is the only character trait I have about Vashti, but I think it's something that's great for us as Christians. What do we see as a quality Vashti has? Why did she refuse? Why? It's exactly why, right? I read some things. Am I going to read some tell about some things I read about what she may have been flaunted as or how she may have been flaunted? However, she had a refusal to compromise for what was right, right? She didn't want to be flaunted around. So I think this is important for us because in today's age, what do we see? Immodesty, right? In our modern world, we have a major compromise in our principles of modesty and shamefacedness for the sake of fashion and popularity. Paul talks about it in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. We won't turn there for the sake of time, but he talks about it to Timothy. So I just think it's a valuable lesson we can learn to refusing to compromise, refusing to compromise for what's right, for the truth, for our morals, and what our conscience is trained to do right. So, yes, ma'am. Miss Joanne, there's no questions tonight. Hang on, let me turn there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, show her off. Yeah, but I think the point of is why did he call for her? Right. Well, right. It doesn't tell us, but, you know, maybe we can speculate that. Right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, she obviously must have known what the deal was, why he was calling her there. Nolan. All right, so, it wasn't a good time. I mean, it wasn't a, Well, I mean, you know, probably some of the men there had been, this has been going on for 6 months and seven more days, right? So, I mean, I don't know. Chris. Good, appreciate that. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Right. So yeah, I chose to kind of like skip over the whole decree thing about you know about the worries of the women revolting basically against their husbands for sake of time, but. Yeah, most definitely. We're going to see that. So Vashti refuses for whatever reason. What happens to her? She's denounced, and we don't hear anything else about Vashti, right? All right, chapter 2. So after she's denounced, the king summons all of his attendants, gather all the beautiful young virgins from all 127 provinces, prepare them with cosmetics to meet the king. I can't imagine how many women, young women, were brought. 127 provinces, you know? That's amazing. However, all this happens, the preparations form, and lo and behold, who's chosen out of all these women to succeed and be the queen? Esther. Okay. So what's the chances, you know, talking about God's providence? What's the chance that Esther gets chosen? I don't know how many. Are there hundreds? Are there thousands of women? I don't have no idea. It'd be nice to know, but we're not told. With God's hand in it, absolutely, right? But I mean, you know, you think about 1 in 500, 1 in, you know, but so. That's not my talk tonight. you know, or just, yeah. All right, so what critical piece of information does Mordecai tell Esther to not reveal? All right, so that she's a Jew. And you remember what we already learned that Esther is to Mordecai? She is obedient, so she listens to him, right? I find it interesting why Mordecai told her to not tell this. Why do you think maybe he told her not to reveal this? Did she have a chance to be queen if they knew? If the king knew that she was a Jew, would she have been picked? Okay. Yeah, so I think here's God's hand in however providing Mordecai information. I hate to say information, but, you know, Mordecai knew to tell her this for some reason, and obviously God's hand being in this, as we know the story in the bigger picture, we see why, because there's a time to reveal it. There was a time to let it be known, and that comes later on. So, chapter 2, verse 15. I think another quality we see in Esther says, "Now in the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king. She did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther was finding favor in the eyes of all who saw her." I find at such a young age, you know, she had some wisdom, it seems, to seek from someone else what she should do and how she should present herself to the king. That's just a little side, but something that obviously seeking advice from others as the queen will be very critical as we go forward. Johnny. Absolutely. All right, so towards the end of chapter 2, we see Mordecai learning about a plot by two of the king's officials or eunuchs to attack the king. He tells Esther about the plot, and she informs the king on Mordecai's behalf, and the two men were hung. We see Esther revealing this to the king in this plot, you know, I think shows some humility in her and humbleness. I mean, she could have taken credit for it, but she didn't. And also, you know, obviously this is a very important part of the story to remember soon in future chapters, because we revisit this portion here soon. So, kicking on. Chapter 3. Who are we introduced to in chapter 3? The lovely Haman. All right, Haman. So we see him being promoted to the king's right-hand man. The king commands all of his servants to bow down and pay homage to Haman. However, there's someone who refused. Who was it? Mordecai. And how did Haman feel about this? Yeah, it infuriated him, right? Everybody bowed down to him but Mordecai. So he sets out to wipe out Mordecai and all of his people. He approached the king about it, had the king write an edict on the 13th day of the 12th month. All Jews in all 127 provinces would be killed. The king gave Haman his signet ring to stamp the edict, which we know makes that official. And once that is stamped, there's no turning back from that edict anymore. That was my next question. Yeah, so Michael said it. This edict would have included killing Esther, right? Because she's a Jew. So I think so, you know. And on top of that, if Haman had known the queen was a Jew, would Haman have ever had this edict made? I don't think there's any way to be discreet to the king, right? Because he'd had to have the king's ring to stamp it. So, you know, just the fact that him not knowing, he pushes forward with his brashness of who he is. Yeah, we're going to talk about Haman's character.
Okay, let's just step back. We don't have any of those people there. I don't know. Apparently, they weren't looked on very favorably.
I agree. So, just to talk about Mordecai for a second in this moment, what do we see in Mordecai when it comes to his refusal to bow down to Haman? Johnny? Right. I've got refusal to compromise again. He refused to compromise his belief in knowing that it was wrong to bow down to anyone but God. So, absolutely. All right, press on to chapter 4. We're going to get through this thing. Tim said I had to 8:15 tonight, just so y'all know. Tim's not even back here. All right. Chapter 4. All right, Mordecai finds out about the edict, heavily distressed, he mourns. Esther's also informed about it by her attendants and the eunuchs. And what's Esther's initial response when she finds out? She was overcome with great fear, right? It scared her. And then what did Mordecai ask her to do? All right. Asked her to go before the king, right? To implore his favor for her people. So, what's Mordecai telling her? Remember what we just said a little while ago? Hey, now's the time to tell him, okay? Now's the time to tell him you're a Jew. You know, now's the time we're going to reveal it. You know, we've been holding it back. God's had a reason why. So now we're going to tell him what's going on. What was Esther's response to Mordecai? The response to go before the king. What's wrong with that? Yeah, right? So what's wrong for anyone to go before the king without being summoned? It's against the law, right? All right. Yeah, so what does he have to do? All right. So if you do that, he has to extend his golden scepter out, basically accepting you, and if not, you're killed, right? All right. What was Mordecai's response? So basically, you know, Esther's like, I got to go before the king, you know, I'm not summoned. I might get killed. What's Mordecai's response? We're going to turn to chapter 4. Yeah, listen to chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, liberation and rescue will arise for the Jews from another place. and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? He says, if you keep silent, rescue will arise from somewhere else. Who's the rescue going to arise from? God, right? So we see another great quality in Mordecai and his faithfulness to God. We saw it before. We see it now. He's a faithful man. And I've got 5 minutes to get through the rest of it. All right. So, and I'm just going to say the question he asked, I love at the end of verse 14. And who knows whether you've not attained royalty for such a time as this? What's he saying? It's part of the plan, right? God put you here for this. You know, that's why you're here. You know, this is your time to shine. So, we're going to skip into chapter 4. And Esther asked for all the Jews in Susa to fast for her for 3 days. She would do the same before she's going to go in and approach the king. Her willingness to go in and approach the king, I think we see some great things about her, and she's willing to do it for her people and die for her people. I see she's courageous. I see she's unselfish to use being put in a position of authority and to use it to serve and do good. I see humbleness on her part, faithfulness, and I see a love for her people that is that agape love, that sacrificial love, willing to die for Mordecai and the Jews just to go before the king. Just some things I see in her in just this instance of whether she goes or not. She didn't have to, but she decided that she will. So chapter 5, the third day she goes before the king. He extends the scepter. He asked what she wanted. She asked for the king and Haman to attend a banquet she's going to prepare for them. So they do. They come to the banquet the next day, and the king asked what her request was, and what did she say? Come to another banquet on the next day. Why would she do that? Does anyone have any thoughts? I think it's allow Haman's head to just go, and we kind of see that, right? I mean, I think it's God's providence, you know, right? I think it's God, his providence working on, he knows Haman's heart, and that Haman's just ego is going to be blown out of the roof by this. Hey, you know, the queen asked me to come with the king to this special banquet, and we get to go again tomorrow. We're going to skip on down, try to make a couple points before we end up here. The time period between the two banquets. We see him gathers his wife and sons and friends. This is Haman. He gloats about all this, which I think is important because what continues to eat at Haman? Who continues to eat away at Haman? Mordecai. Right? So, you know, he's told his wife and his friends about it, and what did they tell him to do? Build a gallows. How big is this thing? It's 75 feet. You know how big 75 feet is? I do. I grew up on a dairy farm. We had a 70-foot harvest door silo I had to climb up. It is tall. It is a spectacle, all right? You could see it from... I remember traveling way down the road, somewhere down a couple, 3 miles away. I don't know, we're on a hill, but you can look back and I can see our silo. Why did he want it to be so big? Everybody see, right? He wanted to make a spectacle out of it. And I think this is important because I think it allows for what we're about to see. One of the king's eunuchs can see this thing when all this takes place. Chapter 6, we're during the night. Tim's letting me go a little bit longer. Bless him. We're during the night. The king gets up. He can't sleep. Has the chronicles brought to him. They read about Mordecai being the one that told him about the plot. Who's out in the courtyard? Haman. Why is he out there? This is at night, right? Why is he out in the courtyard? Yeah, right. It said it was supposed to be the next morning, but like, I don't guess he could wait. You know, so, right. So he goes, tells them what's up, you know, that he goes and didn't say anything, because when he goes, the king confronts him. He's like, hey, what should I do for this a man that's done something so great to honor him? And what does Haman think? This is about me, you know. His pride and his arrogance, his selfishness gets in the way again, thinking it's about me instead. It's about Mordecai. The king tells him what to do, or Haman says, oh, put a royal robe on him and put his royal turban on his head, parade him around town on a horse. And then he finds out this is to be done for Mordecai, right? So this is it, right? Tim's not going to let me get done. Haman's furious. He goes and takes his ball. He runs home, cries to his wife and his friends about it, the wise men, and he's just fit to be tied, right? So they come and grab him. He goes back to the second banquet, okay? And what happens there? The request is made known to the king by Esther to do what? To save her and her people. The king starts to get angry. If you read verse 5 of chapter 7, we won't do it because of lack of time. You can tell he's starting to get furious now. You know, somebody's going to kill my queen, you know, and her people. So here's the eunuch. He looks out. Oh, hey, see that over there? There's a large gallows over there. The king's like, yep. How about we just hang Haman on that? Haman gets hung. He gets what he deserves. We go into chapter 8. Mordecai's given Haman his position. I know that we're forgetting things. However, I do want to get to the take-home message on all this. The take-home message on all this is we see the impact of two faithful people on an entire nation. We read in chapter 8, I believe, it says that there were those who converted in the land that converted to being Jews. I think it's because God's providence had to be seen throughout this, right? I skipped over the part, which was awesome, by the way, of the Haman's wife and friends and everybody telling him that there's no way that you can do anything to Mordecai. Because they saw God's providence, that God was protecting Mordecai. They knew he was a Jew. They knew the Jews was God's people. And they saw him protecting, being protected. And they were like, I think it's in chapter 6. If you want to read it, if you didn't read it already. Yeah, chapter 6, verse 13. And I'll give this and I'll quit. It reminds me of, because I love movies with good quotes. It reminds me of Rocky IV. Who's seen Rocky IV? All right? Okay. You know what happens after Apollo gets killed? And Rocky has the press conference and he accepts the challenge of Drago to go to Russia and fight this big bad Russian that's getting shot up with steroids and he's invincible. Rocky accepts the challenge. Remember, he comes home and he walks in the door. And who's up at the top of the staircase? Adrian. And you remember what Adrian said after they had a little exchange? She says, it's suicide. You can't win. That's what I think of. That Haman's wife and friends and sons told him was that it was suicide. You can't win against him because God's going to take care of him. So anyhow, I had more. We'll end. Thank you for your time.